married, he had kids, and he feels shameful in front of his kids from consuming alcohol or intoxicants, and he forgoes them for this reason, not necessarily because God says so. It happens a lot. The Prophet says, even if somebody does this, he forgoes this sin, not for God's sake, but for the sake of a person, or for somebody else, for some other reason, even then God Almighty will reward him in paradise. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, whoever abandons alcohol for other than the sake of Allah, Allah will quench his thirst in paradise with sealed wine. Actually, the first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was present in the proximity of the Prophet when the Prophet mentioned this and uttered this statement, and the Imam was astonished at this. Because, you know, as a general rule, we know that, you know, we assume that if somebody does a good deed, but not for the sake of God, he won't be rewarded for it. You know, all of our actions are conditioned, the reward for those actions are conditioned with the intention of performing them for the sake of gaining proximity to God. But here, the Prophet said something different. So the Prophet said, the Imam asked, is this really true? How could it? The Imam exclaimed, for other than Allah? Will he be rewarded if he does this for somebody other than Allah? The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam replied, yes, by Allah, for his own protection and well-being. So perhaps it refers to the fact that, you know, if this person does this for the protection of his own well-being and his own, you know, safety and health, you know, then he will be rewarded for it. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the abandoning of alcohol and its rewards, even if it is performed not for the sake of God, rather for the sake of one's own protection and well-being. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
NATO leaders are in Madrid for a summit aimed to set the goals of the military alliance for future. Now, top on the agenda is boosting defenses against Russia and supporting Ukraine. NATO Secretary General has spoken of a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. He's encouraging member states to boost their military spending as well. Finland and Sweden's membership bids are also on the agenda of the three-day summit. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode of the program. We'll have Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, who's joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be Independent International Affairs Analyst Gilbert Doctorow. He is in Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines.
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Now over to Budapest, to George. George, as you know, NATO leaders say that they are going to sign off, as they put it in their own words, on major decisions like a new strategic concept, boosting deterrence and defense, and also greater support for Ukraine. So what do you expect would come out of the summit?
Well, I imagine they will announce this new strategic concept. I mean, we already know the basic outlines of it. They're going to put in a lot of pre-positioned equipment in Eastern Europe. They're going to boost the NATO readiness force. Currently 40,000, they're going to boost it to around 300,000. And they're going to assign different countries to have special relationships with certain other countries in Eastern Europe so that they would be able to transfer their forces rapidly to Eastern Europe. So, for instance, German forces would be rapidly moved into Lithuania. So I think that will be the outlines of the new strategic concept. And, of course, it will name Russia as a threat to NATO. The problem is, of course, is that NATO, by its very existence and by its project of unlimited expansion, is creating its own threat. The more it continues to expand, the more it insists that nothing must stop its expansion, the more it's creating problems, because the more it's creating alarms among other countries in the world. So now they're planning on moving into Asia, which they have to know China is going to look very much askance at it. So, yes, they're labeling Russia as a threat, but this is a threat that NATO has created for itself.
Now, Gilbert, NATO chief Stoltenberg claims it's in everybody's interest to support Ukraine, because if Russia wins, then the world will be more insecure. Do you agree?
As your previous panelist was suggesting, the threat to security is generated by NATO itself. The war in Ukraine is a war that was foisted upon Russia. It was not in their interest or their plans to be fighting this war. But now that they're engaged in it, they are de facto fighting all of NATO. So the meeting in Madrid is going to be appearing before the press and getting the microphone and trying to look very tough and decisive in front of the home voters. But this is posturing. This is not reality. Reality is what's going on in the battlefield in Ukraine. And in this area, Russia is not only fighting against all of the Soviet equipment that had been stored within Eastern Europe by the former Warsaw Pact countries, but it's fighting against the latest equipment that NATO has and only limited supplies for itself. Moreover, it is also fighting against manpower from NATO. It has come out in the last 2 days that there are military and tactical advisors, special forces from Poland, from the United States, actively participating in Ukraine. To say that it's not is a very legalistic and Jesuitical discussion. The fact is that NATO is presently at war with Russia.
Okay. Now, George, would NATO leaders grant membership to Ukraine as a new member of the military alliance, or will they suffice to the countries joining the European Union?
Well, I think that if you look at Article 5, in which it states all members will do whatever they can in the event that one of them is attacked, Well, that's exactly what the NATO member states have done. So everybody has contributed to helping Ukraine. So in effect, Ukraine is a de facto member of NATO. The problem for NATO there is that having essentially thrown their lot in for Ukraine, they don't really have a backup plan, because if things escalate, for instance, with Lithuania, which has imposed a kind of a partial blockade of Kaliningrad, and NATO is blustering that, well, if Russia tries to break the blockade, violates the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lithuania, then Article 5 goes into effect. Well, Article 5 has already gone into effect. Mm. What more will NATO do on behalf of Lithuania that it hasn't already done on behalf of Ukraine? Is going to launch missiles on Russian territory? I don't think so. So it's the problem that kind of NATO has shot its bolt. It doesn't really have a second act.
Okay. Now, Gilbert, NATO is also expected to discuss deploying more troops to Eastern Europe. And as you know, Moscow has said that one of the main reasons for the war in Ukraine is NATO's encroachment on its borders. So what should we anticipate if there are more troops near Russian borders?
Well, the question is whose troops and which governments are controlling those troops. The question of Ukraine is a special case. It has a rabid leadership. It has neo-Nazis in the entourage of the president who are controlling the foreign policy and the military policy of the country. Ukraine is a viciously anti-Russian country intent on military destruction of Russia. It was intent, as was clear from the appearance of Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference earlier this year, it was intent on receiving or developing its own nuclear force with only one objective, to use it or to threaten to use it against Russia. So Ukraine is this wild card. It's the loose cannon on the deck. The other countries in NATO, even the Baltics, have a little bit of common sense, and they have a little bit of restraint and a bit of fear of God and of Russian military power. In that sense, having a large contingent of rapid deployment forces in Eastern Europe does not by itself threaten Russia the same way as a smaller force of 200,000 in Ukraine was an existential threat. It was a state out of control and acting in an irrational and self-destructive way. For that reason, Ukraine had to be stopped. The deployment on a rotational basis, or even with the basic troops in the background, not in the forefront, not on the front line states, whether it's 300,000 or 400,000 or whatever, is not intrinsically an existential threat to Russia.
Now, Georgia, NATO is expanding its presence in Eastern Europe, and its member states, especially the U.S., is flooding Ukraine, you know, with billions of dollars in weapons. Is the U.S. risking a military confrontation with Russia?
Well, it's always a risk, because, this is serious business. For Russia, this is existential. I mean, this is not a war that they're going to lose. It's just simply inconceivable for Russia to lose this war, because then the Russians regard this as the end of their state, their historic state. So this is not a war that they will lose. Therefore, the more the United States, the more NATO gets itself involved directly and indirectly, and they're clearly involved far more extensively than just simply sending in a lot of heavy military equipment. They're involved in targeting. They're involved in destroying Russian military equipment, even targeting maybe Russians on the Russian side of the border. So this is serious stuff, and therefore there is going to be a point at which Russians will get very tired of it. Now, it may well be that Ukraine is already on its last legs. I mean, there are already indications that the level of casualties that Ukraine is sustaining at the moment is something that just cannot go on, and that within the next few weeks, next month, Ukraine military will just simply collapse, in which case that's, you know, the war, at least this phase of the war, will come to an end. But if it doesn't come to an end, then yeah, then absolutely there's a real danger that Russia will come into direct military conflict with NATO member states.
Okay. Now, Gilbert, Sweden and Finland have applied for NATO membership, which requires the consent of all member states, as you know. But Turkey is opposed to this. So your thoughts on that and reasons for Ankara's opposition?
Well, Ankara stated its opposition very clearly. It relates to the very warm welcome that Sweden in particular, and Finland to a lesser extent, have extended to Kurdish refugees, many of whom had been fighting the Turkish government before they left their country and found and sought refugee status. This is a basic demand of Turkey that the Swedes extradite a certain number of individuals who identify by the Turks as being terrorists. It is improbable that the Swedish government will agree to that because of domestic opposition. Therefore, they are at loggerheads. And in the immediate future, it is very doubtful that that Turkey will give its assent to these memberships. So we may expect that this summit will end without any progress on that issue, notwithstanding the fact that for sake of diplomacy and appearances, the parties will meet face-to-face during the summit, that is to say Turkey, Finland, Sweden, and Stoltenberg for the as the director of NATO. Right. No, don't expect any progress on that. Mm-hmm. I think that this is, Turkey is has a legitimate reason, and that is recognized even by Stoltenberg, but more to it, Turkey is exerting its weight. Okay. It has been humiliated by its 22-year candidacy for the EU, and it is taking its revenge by showing its power by being the one hand that goes up, the one hand that has the courage to oppose the 26 other members. And it's going to exercise that right and to demonstrate its key importance in the alliance.
Now, Georgia, NATO is going to boost its rapid reaction force to 300,000, and that's eight times the size of the current force, and this being part of what the alliance itself is calling an era of strategic competition. The question is how costly this strategic competition will be and who's going to foot the bill?
Well, that's a very good question, because these are very big numbers that we're talking about, and Germany itself has already committed to laying out an extra billion, or maybe more than that, what I think, I can't remember, it's 100 billion or whatever, on its military. This is a lot of money. Particularly as already, you know, we've got serious problems with inflation and serious problems with food shortages and the energy. I mean, the EU, as things stand, is committed to cutting off all oil imports by the end of the year. So it's hard to see how Europe can possibly afford any of this. I think it's a highly risky strategy. I think it's for the Russians, they really, for them, they basically said the problem is when they have NATO infrastructure on their borders, and I think that's really the issue. I mean, it's that they cannot have that. It's, you can have all sorts of troops, under NATO command and whatever. But if you start building infrastructure right on its borders, then I think that's a problem. And I think that's the Baltic states, if they start building military infrastructure in the Baltic states, they start building military structure in Finland, if Finland does indeed accede to NATO, I think that will be a problem. And I think that could well be the next round of military confrontation between NATO and Russia. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and their summit to Gilbert, to NATO is going to discuss their new strategy concept in a decade, and that will mention China as a concern for the first time. Of course, member states are not sure how to describe China, that is in position the largest military in the world and has good relations with Russia. Your take on that?
Well, the view to China and the expansion to the east of NATO all the way to China is a kind of metastasis of the cancer that NATO is. I don't think that the Chinese are very alarmed at NATO mentioning them for the first time ever as in their doctrinal statement as a challenge, as particularly as an ideological and values challenge to the EU. That I think they understand that that is this statement, an inclusion in the NATO doctrine, is a kind of Hail Mary, a kind of statement of solidarity with the United States, since the United States is pushing the issue of China as a danger to world security. China is a danger only to U.S. global hegemony. It certainly is not a security danger to Europe in any way. So it's an exaggerated threat that is accepted by European leaders only as they have accepted every harebrained new thought coming out of Washington regarding sanctions and punishing Russia. What we have seen in the G7 summit that has just ended is the kneeling of European leaders before the United States president. None in a more slavish way than Emmanuel Macron, who was caught by cameras running up to Biden, interrupting his conversation, private conversation, in a stroll with Jake Sullivan, and telling him, as we heard clearly in from the microphones, that France is doing its utmost, Europe is doing its utmost, but they cannot live without European oil. Well, there you have it. This is a bunch of knaves, a bunch of servants of the United States, which is itself in a political strife and is led by a senile president. This is a very striking situation, unique, I would say, right. And it doesn't hold the prospect of a strong NATO or of a strong Europe. On the contrary.
Mm-hmm. George, given what's happening and NATO's plan to further expand and give itself a shot in the arm, so what kind of a prospect do you depict for global peace and security?
Well, I think they're quite bleak. I think, again, NATO has undertaken this project. It's like it's obviously not able to survive other than through expansion. And, of course, when you do expand, you come into confrontations with other powers. I mean, we've already seen how it came into confrontation with Russia. There was never any need to do so. Russia gave so many warnings over the years about their concerns of a NATO expansion. Throughout last year, they were giving warnings. In December, you know, they issued those two documents as proposals for a modus vivendi between NATO and Russia. NATO ignored all this and continued. You see, now they're doing this in Asia. Well, China is not going to tolerate the creation of some kind of a NATO in Asia, the purpose of which is essentially containment of China. So in other words, to surround China with enemy states, much as NATO has tried to surround Russia with enemy states. So by doing so, they are provoking a confrontation. I mean, other great powers are just not going to tolerate being surrounded by hostile states. We know this from history. Sooner or later, they're going to react, okay. And the consequence is war.
Now, Gilbert, what about long-standing internal challenges within NATO? Like, if you remember, some countries like France were pushing for a European NATO. Is that on the back burner as it is as NATO is preoccupied with the war in Ukraine?
No, I think things have moved on. What we have now is the EU becoming NATO. The two have become almost identical. And this, the possible admission of Finland and Sweden would take the numbers of EU member states up to something like 23 out of the 12. That is, almost all of the EU member states would then be NATO members. We have to remember that that the EU, though it's widely known as a trading bloc, as an economic unit, as a political force for peace, in fact, it has a very big defense dimension all by itself. And that, going back to 2014, was one of the sticking points why the Russians objected so strongly to the EU running away with Ukraine, because in one of the secret protocols attached to the cooperation agreement that was given to Yanukovych was, of course, the statement that Ukraine would align its foreign policy and its defense policy with the EU. But I'd like to move to take a step back to the question that you just raised about the prospects for peace.
30 seconds, please.
I don't believe that we are in a serious situation. The United States backed away from North Korea, which had one or two nuclear weapons.
Also, that's the end of our show, so let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst Gilbert Todaktura from Brussels.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the topic of housing in the Islamic culture. What we can see in the Islamic teachings is that the Islam praises having a big house for those who need it, for example, those who have more children, whose family is big. On top of that, there are some people who require, whom lifestyle is in a way that they require a big house to live in a big house, so they can have it and it is praised. But on top of that, the structure of the houses should be in a way that it should show some kind of Islamic lifestyle. Generally, what we can see in today's world is people are living in the small compounds, people are living in the apartments, or maybe even they have houses. It is made on the basis or the structure which is being introduced by the West or maybe by a specific religion. Whereas when we talk about the Islamic housing and the structure of the house, when we say it should be Islamic, it means that it should have enough room for everyone. It should have enough room, enough place for the parents to live in a house. It should be having a specific place for praying. It should have a specific place for children to play and a specific place for everyone to get together in the family. And if they have some guests, so they should have a guest room as well. So when we talk Islamically, it looks at all aspects of the life within the house. And when it talks about the structure of the house, it says it should be vast in this way, that there everyone have a specific room or everyone has their own place. And for everything you have, space available in your house. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the housing in the Islamic culture. And obviously, we said that the vast houses or big houses is praised, but according to the conditions that we have, so that it is not against the justice. On top of that, when we talk about the structure of the houses or the building itself, we said that it should have enough room for praying. It should have a specific room, specific place. Now, when we generally go and look at the, in the Islamic world, when we look at the old houses, I generally have experienced it, and I really liked it, that when it is said that there should be a room for prayer, they used to have a room. Even those who go for the pilgrimage, and they might have gone to the house of Imam Ali in the Kufa, and the other a'imma, like the other houses, they would have seen that there is a specific place for praying, and this place was specifically made in the houses, a kind of sanctuary within the house, or a kind of place which used to show the side of Qibla, that this is the way you need to face and pray. And there was a specific place or room, a small room, praying room in the houses previously, where people used to go and pray. And that's why when it was the time to, for example, like for someone to pass away, they used to say to take him to the place where he used to pray. So even in the rooms, in the houses, there was a specific sign, a specific room, small room for praying. In the old Islamic culture, we can see whole houses. Maybe if you visit Iran or other Islamic countries, you might have seen this. And on top of that, the courtyard, especially big courtyards with the trees and all those things, which was a kind of peace. It was a kind of happiness. But we do not find the same peace and happiness in today's world when we are moved into the apartments, when we are moved into the small compounds, when we are moved into the place where we are living in sharing. And this way we are harming ourselves. The stress is increasing in our life. The sickness is increasing. We are not satisfied with what we have. We do not have peace. Therefore, it is necessary to live according to the teachings of Islam. Even when you're about to buy a house or rent a house, choose a house which is according to the teachings of Islam, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
With IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Islamophobic abuse is something most Muslims living in Britain have to deal with, but many were shocked to discover just how dangerous the problem has become. After shocking statistics have been revealed which show a large number of British mosques have become regular targets of hate crime, According to survey data gathered by the Muslim Engagement and Development Group, also known as MEND, and in cooperation with Muslim Census, 42% of mosques and Islamic institutions have faced attacks in the past 3 years, and 35% experienced a religiously motivated attack at least once a year, with racial and religious aggravated offences increasing 15% since last year. In a statement, the government reaffirmed its earlier pledge to provide greater funding for mosque security.
We take a zero-tolerance approach to all forms of hate crime, and we're committed to rooting it out wherever it exists. In addition to funding for projects and organizations which promote diversity and tolerance, we're taking steps to safeguard places of worship with a grant of over £24.5 million available this year.
But a spokesperson from Muslim Census claimed that the government isn't doing enough to tackle the issue.
The Home Office publishes a report every year on the distribution of religious hate crimes, and almost half are experienced by Muslims in this country. Now we've got places of worship included as well. Almost half of the mosques experience some form of religious attack as well. And it is a cause for concern. It is super alarming. And as a Muslim, you think, when will I experience something similar?
The most common form of attack is vandalism, followed by theft. However, many Islamic institutions have expressed deep fear that future attackers may resort to targeting innocent people as opposed to just property, as was the case outside Finsbury Park Mosque during a deadly terrorist attack targeting the establishment in 2017. Robert Carter, London.
An official Iranian delegation headed by Chief of the IRIB, Peyman Jibili, arrived in Damascus and met with Syria's Prime Minister Hossein Arnous, who called for expansion of ties with Iranian media outlets for unmasking false media campaigns that some countries launched to mislead the public opinion on the truth of events in West Asia. Jibili, who also had a separate meeting with Minister of Information Boutros Halaq, said economic pressure on Syria is a result of Syria's triumph on terror and the defeat of enemies, stressing the importance of strong cooperation in confronting the media war against the two states.
Our meetings with Syrian officials will open a new and wide page in cultural and media cooperation. Due to Syria's resistance and its allies, the war on Syria failed in its objectives. We should document this victory in the mind of the Arab and world public opinion, and this requires a high level of cooperation with Syria in the media sector. This is what we agreed on today.
Coordination among media sectors is highly important. We as a resistance alliance are facing media empires which no state can face alone. We should face pressures, sanctions, and false campaigns. So we all should combine efforts in Iran, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine.
Meanwhile, the delegation participated in a seminar held in rejection of normalization of relations with Israel. Jibili said the reason behind pressures on the peoples of the region is the failure of enemies' conspiracies, asserting there is no future for normalization with Israel.
The normalization of relations with Israel that we witnessed recently by some states in the region is almost coming to an end because the people do not accept it. Normalization has no future because it is against the principles of humanity. Normalization with the killer of children and journalists is not logical. We will defeat the enemy in the media just like we fought the conspiracies, and that is only if we are united.
The delegation is scheduled to hold more meetings on Tuesday and sign agreements with Syrian media outlets. The visit aims to further boost cooperation between the media sectors of both countries to reach the level of strategic relations between Syria and Iran and strongly counter the media war waged against member countries of the Resistance Alliance. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen Humanitarian Response Plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported, that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen, will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the Quran truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Unlawful and unfair. This is how experts refer to Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian judiciary official who has been in detention in Sweden for the past 2 years over alleged prisoner abuse in 1988. Here in Iran, this group of law experts have gathered to examine the rights violations Sweden has committed against Hamid Nouri for charging him without solid evidence.
None of those who testified against Mr. Nouri were eyewitnesses. They have never been in touch with him. So Stockholm's court should have not involved itself in false accusations leveled against Mr. Nouri by a terrorist entity. The Swedish justice system is violating international law by interfering in another country's judicial system.
The suit was lodged by members of the Mujahideen Khalq organization, or shortly MKO, a formidable terror group responsible for most of the assassinations that have targeted Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The terror group claims that Nouri was involved in the execution and torture of its members in 1988. The Swedish prosecutor has charged Nouri with war crimes and crimes against humanity, something which the ex-Iranian official dismisses as imaginary. These people say MKO itself has committed countless war crimes with impunity.
MKO terrorists have the blood of some 17,000 Iranians on their hands. They assisted former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his 8-year war against Iran. They have committed thousands of war crimes and must be punished by the international legal systems. Yet we see that Sweden simply ignores the MKO crimes and instead accuses a retired Iranian judicial clerk of war crimes.
Swedish prosecutors have now requested the maximum penalty of life imprisonment for Hamid Nouri. The final verdict is scheduled to be handed down to Nouri on July 14th.
It seems that the entire case is a political campaign aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's judicial system. I think if the Swedish judiciary pursues righteousness, it will vindicate Mr. Nouri of all the charges.
Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. Nouri, now 61, has been held in solitary confinement for over 2 years now.
Experts here say Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri follows baseless allegations made by a terrorist organization, and therefore it has no legal grounds. They asked Sweden to immediately release the Iranian national. Otherwise, they say, it could be construed that the Swedish judicial system is swayed by the MKO terror group. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A 6-year-old girl lies in her coffin. Her name is Alina. She was killed by Ukrainian army shelling of the Donetsk region. Her family and the local community mourn together. As she's taken away to the burial site, her grandmother bids farewell to to her beloved granddaughter for the last time. She asks for forgiveness.
Now, Alina was killed. Speaking to locals and the family, they tell me that she was killed because of a Ukrainian shell that was fired in this direction, and an anti-air defense missile fired by the Russians hit that missile in the mid-air, and shrapnel showered to the ground to kill Alina.
There was the massive boom of the anti-air defense working. Alina didn't die straight away. She was taken to hospital and died 2 days later. The clock is stopped at 6:12, the moment Alina's heart stopped beating. She arrives at the burial site. Her family say their final goodbyes.
Now, there's something particularly shocking about a child killed in war. Few people here can hold back the tears. While millions of people in NATO countries continue to encourage their governments to send more weapons to Ukraine instead of negotiating for peace, the fact of the matter is, the longer this war goes on, the more children like Alina will be killed.
A memorial in Donetsk. The sign reads, "To the children killed in Donbass since 2014. There is no end date, as children continue to die. Mourners take their turn to pay their final respects. For 8 years, Ukraine has targeted and killed civilians here in Donetsk. President Zelensky, lionized in the West for defending European values, has continued the policy. Alina's whole life was lived during this war, a war now escalated by the Russian invasion and NATO's policy of arming Ukraine instead of pushing for negotiations. This is the true reality of war." Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
To the southeast of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina exists a cemetery that is the most famous and holiest in the Islamic world, Jannatul Baqi, meaning the Garden of Heaven. After the dawn prayers, the gates of Baqi are opened for a few hours, and crowds of Muslim pilgrims flock to it. Baqi is the main burial ground for the people of Medina since the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and contains graves of many of the Prophet Muhammad's family and companions.
In order to describe the importance of Baqi Cemetery, I have to say it is a rendezvous of thousands of Muslims every day.
Baqi is honored to host the tombs of four infallible Imams, Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, Imam Ali Zain al-Abidin, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon them. Today, there is no trace of the shrine that used to contain their tombs. Close to the graves are the remains of the House of Sorrows, a place where the Prophet's daughter, Lady Fatima, used to come to and shed tears of grief over the loss of her father.
When you enter in Mazari Baqiya, when you enter Mazari Baqiya, there you become very, you know, emotional.
It is also believed that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, often prayed in Baqi whenever he was passing through.
Baqi is like no other cemetery in the world of Islam. It's a place of absolute sanctity for all Muslims. Therefore, Hajj pilgrims every year visit this place to pay tribute to the relatives and companions of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington, but We agreed today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and US, facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating.
The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector.
The National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has said household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month.
Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
السلام عليكم and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem with Habibullah Fazizada and also our dear students from Sevier International School and IRIB Radio, English Radio. So we really welcome you all and thank you so much for joining us again. We hope that everyone is fine and healthy and inshallah protected from all evils. Thank you so much for joining us again. Inshallah, now we will continue our previous session with reciting Surah Al-Fatiha, and then inshallah we'll go through Surah Al-Nazi'at. We will have some exercises on heavy letters and light letters. Then inshallah we'll go to the new lesson, which is about the rules of Tanween and Nunis Hakim. So, it's Hussein Musa who is going to inshallah recite Surah Al-Fatiha and we will listen to him. Let's see how he recites it, inshallah. Okay?
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. Malik Yawmiddin. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
ما شاء الله, that was nice. Thank you so much. Was there any other mistake? What about عين? Was he like reciting the, producing the عين sound correctly? Like صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم. He said, I remember. He said صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم.
ننت.
ننعمت. It means the hamza was not clear and then the عين sound was not clear. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم. عليهم also. عليهم, you said. Yeah. So be careful because it's very important, okay? This pronunciation of the letters. So when the Quran says أوزيد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا, this tartila, there is a hadith, I think, from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says this tartila means that you